Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Camby Report. It is 195 days until the Vancouver municipal elections. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the big news of this past couple of weeks, Shauna Sylvester entering the race as a independent or quote-unquote independent, depending who you ask. One of the names being put forward to run for a COPE nomination or an independent, who knows. Where the NPA is at, and I guess a bit of revisiting of the Metro Vancouver remuneration policy that we discussed last time. And then we go back into the mailbag to see how people are finding the show.
Again, we really do appreciate your feedback. And please, in addition to liking and subscribing on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other things, keep your comments coming, because it really gives us a sense of, you know, what people are thinking about in the region and what we should be reporting on. So, starting off at the top, Shauna Sylvester, independent mayoral candidate. She is not running for a political party. She's not running for Visions. She is the SFU director of the University Center for Dialogue, which doesn't sound like anything at all.
The Center for Dialogue runs a whole host of talks in Vancouver around
really
municipal issues. Municipal issues, things like that. It's actually a really fascinating group, and they brought together some really interesting things under her watch. She's been there for a little while. Before that, she's been on nonprofit boards and organizations boards for quite a long time. She spent time on the board of Van City Credit Union, as well as the treasurer of Mount Equipment Co-op. So she does have quite the background in terms of the nonprofit and advocacy fields. And on paper, she's a pretty solid unity candidate. If everyone can get on board with the fact that she used to be on Vision Vancouver's board of directors as well, and has been heavily involved in that party historically, and I know that there's a lot of antagonism there.
Quote, "We need a bridge builder, somebody that can work across differences, and I've done that for 30 years, she says, having mastered the art of the non-statement.
Mastered the art of the dialogue, even. There was a nice piece in the Vancouver Sun, very almost sympathetic, but raising this question of, will she have the name recognition? I think we'll get to that question in a second, but saying, I guess before she announced, she hosted journalists at like tea at her house in East Van to just sit down and talk about the city issues. And everyone found her very charming, welcoming, friendly, but didn't really seem to have deep answers on any policy questions. Maybe that's because all of the big issues facing Vancouver are complicated, and anyone selling you a simple answer is probably
I kind of don't see that as being overly surprising. I wouldn't be surprised if John Cooper or Hector, well, I mean, Hector Bremner is a one-issue candidate. I mean, his issue is the most important issue in the city, but I wouldn't be surprised if John Cooper was exactly the same. I can tell you that Gregor Robertson was very similar in 2008 when he first announced his bid to run. He was jumping into municipal politics from another field because he was an MLA at the time, and he didn't know a whole lot of the issues at hand. And I think when you're a steady politician, you don't want to make declarative statements as you're entering a field, because you don't know a lot of the issues.
If you don't want to make declarative statements, quote, "I spent a lot of time working trying to address problems, bringing people who do not necessarily agree together at the table to come up with a better end. It's not a set of skills that a lot of people have. I have it. I think it's what Vancouver needs right now. So I think that uniquely positions me to play this role."
Is that not accurate?
It's impossible to be inaccurate. That's a statement that literally anyone could make and it would be true. "I spend a lot of time working trying to address problems. That is literally the definition of existence."
Anyways, I think she seems to have a lot of respect coming out of a lot of the fields and a lot of places that she's worked before. I have heard rumblings that she's a bit of a taskmaster when it comes to her staff. I mean, I don't know how much of that is real or how much of that, or because I have no firsthand knowledge of that. But she does seem to be quite a strong candidate.
She has gotten criticism from the more left-leaning parts of Vancouver, both for who is she, you know, who is this person? But I found that fell a bit flat, because even the big name in this race so far, John Cooper, is kind of a who's that to, I bet, 95% of Vancouverites. And he's elected right now.
Well, and I think even Shauna Sylvester's had more media attention while she wasn't a candidate than John Cooper has while he was.
I'm making fun a little bit of her statements, but she actually did talk
awfully negative.
And I was about to be a little positive, but now I'm not going to because I have been shot down. So I'm going to have my little snit, and I'm not going to talk about how she was specific about how young people were leaving Vancouver or small businesses were losing out. I'm not going to mention that at all.
The other line of criticism that has come up against her is, like you mentioned, she was on the vision board. So there's this, is she a vision shill? Or is she just a vision front? Like, Vision knows they're too toxic to run a mayoral candidate. So they're like behind the scene. And you can get into a conspiratorial level of like the agents, provocateurs are behind the scenes pushing her.
There's definitely a whiteboard with a lot of string involved in this. I think it's possible. It is entirely possible that Vision has decided that that's going to be their semi-candidate without a name, without the party name attached. I think it's also equally possible that she's deciding to run independently because she doesn't see Vision as the viable vehicle. It's also possible that maybe Vision is having greater internal problems than we know of and we can see. I don't know. I'm not speaking to anything I've heard, but it's possible that that's also there. When parties are going through this sort of down phase that Vision is in, and I think it's undeniable to say that Vision is in a really, really down spell, people break away from them. That's where the Alberta like political scene has five different left parties, right? Because no one can agree to work together.
They not anymore.
Sigh out of existence. Like there's a deep sighing noise, and a chunk of the party breaks away.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is common in Vancouver historically for the left, right? The team parties that were on the center. COPE has spawned multiple parties over the years. Even in the last two decades, COPE has spawned two different viable political parties. So
might not be great news for Vision that one of their former board members is running independent. That might be an indication of Vision having a realistic assessment of what their brand is like in the city. It might be that former Vision people think that the brand is too toxic, neither of which is a great place for a political party to be in.
No, not at all.
But Shauna Sylvester seems to think that running for mayor as an independent is going to bring her a greater chance of victory, unless, of course, she's a secret shill, which, I mean, who knows?
Well, the one thing I'll say that maybe hints at that as being slightly more than not impossible is she hasn't really come out with literally any criticisms of Vision as a party or as Gregor's.
That's not true. She has criticized how partisan Gregor was.
Interesting.
Yeah, she said that. Well, this is the beginning of she comes at things differently from the current mayor, and quote, "I'm excited about actually working with people that aren't just in political parties, that look at the world in different terms and channel that energy differently." Yeah, so it's an oblique criticism, but I still think that...
I guess that flashes back to, like, Gregor's and like NPA hacks comment that he made a couple of years ago and so on.
Yeah, and especially, like, given that Gregor's key lieutenants in the party have been particularly partisan and negative about opposition councillors.
Yeah,
so
I think that's true.
I think that it is a salient criticism, and I will be very interested in seeing what that kind of nonpartisan approach might bring her.
It has been reported, and I've heard rumblings myself, that internally Vision is really divided over whether or not to run their own branded mayor. It does come with a lot of benefits, is that you've got a mayor to galvanize your team. It does have a lot of negatives, and that you're pulling one of your star people off of the council seat and putting them into a spot where they might lose. And it, you know, it might further divide the left. So it is interesting to see. And my understanding is that debate is going to play out internally for some time. I'm really curious to see where Vision lands.
I think all the parties except the NPA are pretty much in that same position. You see it in the Greens right now.
Yeah, you're right, actually.
And maybe COPE is more of a fuck them all, but one city is definitely in the, like, we're probably not running someone because we want to work with the others.
Well, and one city can use the Green model as well. Where they can look at a recent model of the Greens running a candidate or two and getting one in and now building and becoming a viable party, and that the Greens never did need to run somebody for mayor, even though people kept consistently demanding that they do.
It's better to offer nothing but have that demand there than offer someone and fail.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be very interesting to look at going forward. We do have to move on to our next topic, a little further left. COPE. It's a party that is managing, I guess you could say.
I believe moribund is the word of the day that I would use for them.
They have a new board.
They have a new board.
As any society would on an annual basis, essentially. But...
So yes.
As any society would.
Time advances.
They are still a registered organization.
Actually, that itself is news, because I wasn't sure.
I mean, at times it would be surprised, yeah.
So, yes, congratulations to the new board of COPE. Certainly, their recent electoral and general organizational fortunes have not been great, but Patrick Condon has been urged to run for mayor for that party. So who is Patrick Condon?
Patrick Condon is a landscape architect at University of British Columbia. He discusses a lot of transportation policy issues as well as density issues. He's oftentimes been seen to be an opponent of density or at least height. He's oftentimes seen to be an opponent of rapid transit as well. He prefers transit to be slower. So that you can take in your neighborhood and you force people to live closer to where they work and things like that as a mechanism towards what he considers better city building. I wouldn't necessarily put myself in his camp a lot of the time when it comes to the practicalities. He does bring interesting philosophy to the table when it comes to the conversation around transit.
Like, I can see that argument that Vancouver can put a lot more streetcars and light rail down for the cost of the Broadway subway.
Yeah, that's one of his arguments kind of as well, is that you can build out a significantly bigger network. It's silly to say that we don't need the Broadway subway.
No, yeah. And I totally agree.
Yeah.
Condon's, yeah, definitely been urged, and there's a few people quoted from COPE who are urging him. I saw him quoted in the Vancouver Sun, though, sort of hedging his bets, saying he didn't really want to run for a party banner. He'd rather be this sort of unity candidate.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You don't have to have any of the party baggage, and you can have everybody pulling for you.
I can have three votes instead of one. Yeah.
So, like, in the Democratic primaries in the States, there has occasionally been so much enthusiasm that, like, all the oxygen is getting sucked up out of the area, and they're finding, like, problems in which candidates are running because there are just too many, and they might crowd out the field. Vancouver seems to be having the opposite problem, is that everyone is so uninterested. Like, everyone is circling, deciding whether or not to, like, reach in and grab something, and they don't want to actually, like, stick their neck out because they're afraid it's going to get chopped off. I'm not sure where this metaphor has gone, but...
No, I think you raised a really good point. And the other thing with that, too, is that, like, the U.S. primaries and political parties' internal mechanisms will have a system in place for how to determine a mayor. But right now, there's this sort of tap dance where there's no rules, and all the parties are going to maybe come to an agreement. And I know in past years when there was agreements, there wasn't an agreement between COPE and Vision last election, but in the previous election there had been. It was a really drawn-out process to build that agreement and come up with that especially tripartite agreement, or however many parties are going to be involved in this agreement. You know, who gets how many seats to run for council? You know, who the mayor is going to be? There's no structure for it.
Do we
really
want to lose to the NPA together or apart?
Not to throw it totally back to our electoral system discussion in episode one, but when people complain about proportional representation systems and all the backroom dealing that happens after the election, we've kind of just front-loaded it with this system.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's a good entirely. Point. Yeah, well, and like, somebody did point out that, you know, when Shauna Sylvester announces she's running, and people say she's a good or a bad candidate, and, you know, there's arguments on both sides, but people say, you know, she should be afraid of crowding out and allowing the NPA to win on a split vote. That means that our electoral, somebody pointed this out on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, that means our electoral system is broken. Like, if candidates are being discouraged to come forward because the electoral system might allow somebody...
I don't agree with that.
Well, if you have, you know, seven cats and one dog running for election, and there's a great British video that you can look up about this.
Yeah.
You're going to have all the cat vote divided between the seven cats, and the one dog is going to sneak in.
But let's get back to the mouse vote on the...
Yeah, let's go back to Mouseland.
Mouseland. And Patrick Condon. So he would prefer to be the independent, but COPE is trying to get him as their... And there's a bit of excitement on COPE Twitter, if that's a thing. I think it's like two or three people, but do you think if he can galvanize, does he have a chance to get that nomination? Would he get some excitement beyond just that corner, or would he be like the
people who are still involved in COPE are very excited, and because you'd have to be.
I don't think I have a read on where COPE would go on things, because I think that they're such dyed in the wool, like, they're the last bastion of hard left politics in Vancouver. And so I don't know which direction they'll go at any given moment.
In the Georgia Strait article on Patrick Condon, it says that no one is perhaps more qualified to run the city as Condon, which I think
he's never been elected to dog catcher.
It cites his role as the founding chair of the urban design program at SALA, which is a school of architecture and landscape architecture at UBC. And sure, that is important. But it does not really, that's not really what a mayor does. A mayor is an executive.
Yeah,
they have to manage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's this theory that people can jump in and be mayor. And mayor is a complicated job.
Rob Ford did it. Sort of.
Wow, that was a long silence.
I think what Carlito Pablo, I think, was the journalist of that, is trying to get at is he's got a background in, I guess, academic administration level. He's worked on these kinds of issues.
Well, he's done a lot of work on density and zoning and that kind of thing. And so there is some amount of knowledge that he brings.
And you look at our current mayor, his background was in selling juice.
Well, yes, but he ran a company, and that I think is more to running a city.
And he'd been in MLA for 3 years at that point, not necessarily in opposition. So it's not like he was running a ministerial portfolio, but he'd been in MLA for a couple of years. He'd, like you say, run a business. Yeah,
yeah, and being head of a program at UBC is not an insubstantial thing, but it's I think a different beast from managing a city of 600,000 people.
He would certainly bring a significant amount of conversation to the table to oppose the abundant housing type arguments that exist. I think he would very much be a voice, not one that I would necessarily agree with a lot, to sort of go up against the Hector Bremners, and maybe that's something that's valuable to have in the discourse.
Speaking of the Hector Bremners, all one of them is now facing some competition for the NPA mayoral nomination, some serious competition from John Cooper, who is currently a park board
commissioner.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about his announcement on the last episode, but what's been noticeable, I think, since then is the relative media presence of Cooper versus Bremner versus Chernin, the also ran cranky old NPA. No offense to the cranky old NPA. They need their voice. Cooper seems to be attracting attention wherever he goes, and it kind of shows that old guard is definitely not gone.
Yeah. Well, and that was reading A Matter of Confidence, or I think it was A Matter of Confidence, where they talk about Sam Sullivan beating Christy Clark for the mayoral nomination, was that he ran on, uniting the existing membership of the NPA behind him. And that seems to be John Cooper's plan to beat out Hector Bremner and the other guy, Chernin. And, maybe it works. It seems like he's got a lot of support from the old guard NPA types.
Tick-tock. April 29th approaches, and that is when the NPA membership cutoff is. So, what is Hector Bremner doing right now? He is selling memberships.
Yep. And I've heard rumors that there's some pretty heavy hitters working on his campaign team. I haven't been able to confirm them yet, but there are some names being floated about that are working on his campaign that are quite well known. And so if he does have that, I would say he's got a good chance. If he doesn't have some pretty substantial organizing heft, I think he might be an also-ran at the end of the day.
Of course, there's also that argument out there, and I'm not going to give it too much merit by really referencing it directly, that progressives should maybe try to undercut the Bremners and the Coopers by joining en masse and voting Wei Young, even though she's not running for the NPA nomination, as far as I can tell.
Okay, so this is referencing a Charlie Smith article, which, as far as I can tell, was just
ideas on a paper.
It was literally written after he left a pot expo.
Well, I can't fault people for doing on-the-ground research, but the cannabis community needs to recognize that prospective NPA mayoral candidate John Cooper is not their friend. It's the title of this article. He is suggesting that people join a party that they don't really support.
Well, and that just doesn't really happen. Yeah. I think we saw an attempt of it in the last federal conservative leadership race.
Except Alberta.
A lot of, except Alberta.
Well, there was the draft Michael or vote Michael Chong kind of
progressives in.
Well, yeah, but like there are like progressive conservatives left in the conservative party.
But like I think the thing is that this seems to come up a lot is this like join the party that you don't agree with and vote. And people don't do that. Like you and I, Matthew, we were saying before the podcast, like combined, we've been involved in partisan politics for, you know, 25 years, 30 years. And
it's a statement of personal
identity. I've never really seen people do it. Yeah.
Like
they, and I've certainly never seen it done in an organized fashion.
Like people I mentioned joined en masse for Jason Kenney to take over the progressive conservatives in Alberta and then use that to take over the merge with the Wild Rose. But I think that was a special case of like,
I think that's a merger situation rather than joining to try to kibosh or
definitely wasn't a sabotage situation like the, oh, what if people join to get Donald Trump to win the nomination and then that'll work out well for Hillary?
Well, I think it was like in Alberta in particular, it was a question of let's join both because these are both legitimate expressions of the conservative movement in Alberta. And I am a conservative, and so therefore I am going to join this party, and then we are going to merge them to just, like, sort out the legal shenanigans.
It is funny to me, this, like, it's really easy for us to report on what's going on with the NPA, right? They're running a mayor, they're having a mayoral race, there's a deadline to get your memberships in, we can cover that pretty easily.
They're fighting their fights in public.
Yeah, and they are fighting their fights in public, too, which is really interesting to see this, like, fighting between the more housing people and the sort of traditional NPA.
And there is exactly the right amount of housing people.
No housing in my backyard. But the fascinating thing is that it's easy for us to cover that, but it's so difficult for us to figure out this like unity mayor and cover all of that because there's so much going on involved with that. And there's so many different factors.
If you're in the Vancouver District Labor Council, send us a direct message and we'll report that anonymously if you need it.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's all that needs to be said on the MPA. Finally, let's turn back to last episode, where the Metro Vancouver pay pension issue came up. And it looks like the cash grab / reasonable compensation issue has triggered the crumpling of the spines of the people on the Metrovan board. So Metrovan chair Greg Moore apparently is going to be planning on introducing a motion later this month to reconsider the retroactive pension increase. What do we think of this?
Shocking how often this seems to happen, that a legislature will vote itself a pay increase or a federal parliament will vote itself a pay increase and then an uproar will occur and they will walk it back. It's really frustrating to me how often this seems to happen, this weird, like, don't pay people money thing. You know, I'm not surprised.
I think the one thing we touched on a little bit last time was the issue that seemed to be unique to this one, the where did this come from, the shock at it. The retroactive bit, I probably irked a lot of people, like, hey, remember when you were on the board 10 years ago? Now you get a pension.
Especially the time frame of that retroactive. Going back 11 years was very large.
And so I can see where the outrage came from that. And maybe they knew it was coming, so they started with something absurd so that they could reintroduce something
moderate. They're going to walk it back to still be a pension, but not as backdated or something. Yeah,
but that seems too strategic for the Metrovan board, who probably gets one story a year.
Well, and as of right now, it's really just Port Coquitlam Mayor Greg Moore is the one that said that he's going to introduce the motion at the next meeting, which is also interesting because Greg Moore's not up for re-election. He's not running again. He doesn't have any need to make sure that he minimizes blowback to himself or anything like that. So maybe he's just taking a principled stand.
Or actually, he was the one who was defending it most, so maybe he's actually just minimizing blowback by allowing the vote to happen to fail and get the pension anyway. So
could be.
Who knows? No. I think they should just keep it. You know what? Fine.
Yeah, I don't see a reason not to well compensate people that donate their time.
Do either of you know of better models to this? Because this debate comes up frequently in every municipality, every provincial legislature, every national. And sometimes they'll say, all right, we have a special committee or
to an arm's length body to make recommendations. And then it still needs to be voted on.
Well, it's the thing that I have seen as the best suggested model that I can think of is having a fully graded civil service pay scale and having politicians be somewhere on there.
Oh, they should unionize politicians.
Well, and even civil servants, like even the actual bureaucrats, aren't necessarily compensated in a manner that makes a lot of sense. And so, like not necessarily the civil servants, but the political hires that exist, like ministerial aides and stuff like that. BC pays one of the lowest rates in the country. And what typically will happen is, you know, a government will sit for a while without raising pay for any of these people because they're afraid of the political blowback. And then a new government will come in and have to hire a bunch of people and realize that it's really hard to hire people and get them to move to Victoria when you don't pay very much. And then they raise the pay and then they get the blowback from that.
So you could have a independent commission that set pay grades. So you could be like an A1, A2, A3, mm-hmm. B1, B2, B3. And, you know, say Metrovan things get a C1 pay scale and a B2 pension, blah, blah, blah. That would be perfectly fine. And that's just where they sit. And every time it gets negotiated, that's where things are. But instead, we have people setting their own pay because they are the board of the thing that is paying them, and that is how societies have to work.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why we as a society need to spend so much time arguing about the pay of our politicians rather than what our politicians are doing.
I think the move is probably ultimately politically smart to do, to walk it back a bit, whether or not that motion even passes. It's a way to just try to throw a bit of contrition, try to kill the stories, and take attention off the Metrovan board. I don't think they really want publicity most of the time.
I mean, they could refer this to committee, which would be the ultimate, like, death.
Yeah.
So we're going to follow this motion, just, you know, out of morbid curiosity. So be warned. But my suspicion is that this motion, if it comes up, might, like, slowly fade away into the legislative and parliamentary fractal nature of any organization, some committee and a subcommittee. And a subcommittee evermore. Feedback. We got some feedback from the last episode. Do you want to start off with my statements? Yes.
So none of us are Green supporters.
No.
No.
Have any of us ever voted Green?
I've voted for Pete Frye in the past.
Okay.
As well as Misha Oak for school board. So I've voted for a couple of Greens before.
No. But there was a comment you made, Matthew, in the last episode about...
Yes, I said that the Green Party should stop being so regressive and awful, and I retract the statement. I meant to say that Adrian Carr's voting record on council has been regressive and awful. If either Pete Frye or Adrian Carr or any other candidate for the Greens for elected office in the city wants to come forward and talk about it, then they are more than welcome to come on the podcast. And, you know, since I should say nice things, I think Dr. Janet Fraser has been okay, if not good, at being on the school board.
So I think Pete's already offered, and we're definitely going to take him and other candidates up at some point in the future. We're trying to establish some kind of voice because candidates who come on have a message to spin, and it's a bit difficult to keep a discussion going when they're just here to talk. But I want you to maybe expand a little bit on that. You say Adrian's regressive and awful voting record.
So I think that Adrian Carr's policies have been to oppose increases in density and and kind of take a position that is, if it is green, it is not environmentalist, it is pastoralist, which is...
Well, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Like, can we create Deep England in the Dunbar Southlands area? Probably not, but that's not going to stop Adrian Carr from trying. Let's ban bikes from a certain street without voting to improve the bike lanes. This is the kind of policy that I'm talking about.
She's also consistently defended parking minimums for apartment builds as well. Minimum parking requirements are seen to be fairly regressive. They also contribute to the housing crisis because they make housing more expensive to build, and they enable significantly more cartopia that exists, or motordom as it's called. And that's not a green policy at the end of the day. And
it's not an environmental policy. It is a green policy.
Well, no, but it is. And that's an interesting problem within the Green Party, is that Adrian Carr is the Green Party municipally, and she's pretty bombastic. She says kind of whatever the crowd in front of her wants to hear sometimes, and that's very frustrating for me.
Well, and it's still popular within the party, as they have endorsed her as a mayoral candidate.
Well, when
she wants it,
when you're a small party, and I can say this because I've been a New Democrat supporter for many years, when you're in a small party and you don't typically win, the second you have somebody that gets you close, you really idolize them. Just like I love Trevor Linden, you know, Trevor Linden got us very close to the promised land of the Stanley Cup. And, you know, I'm sure the Greens feel the same way about Adrian Carr as they do about Trevor, the Canucks fans about Trevor Linden, is that she got on council and she's an important voice on council, and they...
And winning is fun.
And they don't, yeah, and they don't get that very often.
And partisanship is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, that too.
Oh, yes.
Our other feedback corrections were a bit more minor. Mike Klassen liked the shout out, so we're giving him another shout out because you got to feed the love, I guess. But he did point out that he was not Sam Sullivan's chief of staff, but what he described as a contractor.
Yeah, he worked within the mayor's office. And I had known that him and Daniel Fontaine was the chief of staff. And both of them were sort of key lieutenants for Sam.
And that is all. Thank you, everyone. Please check in with the Cammy Report on Facebook and on Twitter. Like, subscribe, leave those 5-star reviews on iTunes. That really helps us out. And with only 195 days left, we will try and keep you informed as to the ins and outs of Vancouver municipal politics. If you have a scoop for us on any of the surrounding suburbs, please also get in touch.
Oh, send us emails, cambyreport@gmail.com. Follow both of our shows, of course, if you like listening to our voices. Mine's Politicoast with Scott DeLangeboom.
And we're on Podkeep Our Land, which we'll be recording tomorrow. And we're very excited to get chatting away about Kinder Morgan and all the things that have been going on with that today.
Finally, we have all recovered from the plague, which...
Unfortunately, most of the podcasters have been sick. 2 out of 3 podcasters, I think, have been sick for most of the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And not always the same two.
It was a rough couple of weeks in the Podkeep Our Land infirmary. So... We're looking forward to being back and talking a little more provincial and national politics with you. But without further ado, I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Good night.